Welcome back to another episode of Conduct Detrimental. I'm Taryn Sharma, and with me today is John Nucci. Nucci, how's it going?
Hey, Taryn, what's going on?
Nothing much. You know, the world of sports law never sleeps. And in particular, we've got a lot of college sports news this week. Wanted to definitely talk with you. You had a great article this week on Conduct Detrimental on our blog about college golfers. So we're going to talk about that. But first, I wanted to speak about the Iowa football lawsuit. In 2020, a few years ago, a group of 12 former Iowa Hawkeye football players who are Black sued the University of Iowa, alleging racial discrimination and mistreatment under head coach Kirk Ferentz. And initially, this lawsuit was seeking $20 million. This week, a settlement was announced for $4.175 million, and the Iowa Athletic Department is going to handle $2.175 million of that amount, and then the taxpayers of Iowa are going to handle the rest. This is a pretty big group. Some notable names in there that you might remember. I don't know if you remember this guy, Nooch, Akram Wadley.
I do. I do remember him. He's the only one on there that I recognize, but I do remember him.
Yeah, he was the only name that I really remembered as well. Wadley and 11 other players are going to receive somewhere in the neighborhood of $184,000. This didn't come smoothly, of course. The Iowa State Appeal Board, one of their members, a guy named Rob Sand, stated that he was not going to support the taxpayer funding of the settlement unless Iowa Athletic Director Gary Barta stepped down. Barta, well-known figure, right? He was the head of the College Football Playoff Committee up until recently, or he still might be. Definitely a big player in college sports.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason that Rob Sand said that he would vote against that, or that he was against that, is there apparently have been three or four prior racial discrimination cases while Gary Barta has been AD at Iowa since 2006, totaling like $7 million in payouts. So it was a three-member appeals board. They voted 2-1. The other two essentially said that personnel demands shouldn't be a factor in approving public funds, but that was actually a request of the original lawsuit, or that they wanted Gary Barta out. So I guess that didn't make it into the ultimate settlement. But yeah, it's certainly a very interesting case. And it's also interesting, I saw that Kirk Ferentz put out some comments about how basically they had filed a motion to dismiss, I believe, or maybe a motion for summary judgment.
Yeah,
it was a motion for summary judgment. Right. And then the settlement actually came down, or was negotiated and agreed to, before the judge ruled on that. So
and without any input from the coaches, right? So
right.
That's something that that Kirk Ferentz, who's in his own right been a pretty legendary figure at Iowa. You know, John Rothstein, the college basketball commentator, he likes to come up with these nicknames. He says Iowa basketball is the family business. Well, Iowa football, kind of the same way. Brian Ferentz has been the offensive coordinator and recently received a new contract, even though they finished 130th out of 131 FBS programs offensively. And now he's got a certain number that he's got to hit. And I know that we had some fun with that on Twitter, because if you look at it, the points per game have to be a certain amount. Well, Iowa only has a certain number of games. So it's really like a countdown of the number of points that I was going to have to hit.
Yeah.
Luckily for Brian Ferentz, the defensive touchdowns do count. But the other major figure in this case, John, Chris Doyle, is a strength coach who was named in the lawsuit as well. He was put on administrative leave in the summer of 2020 when this case first was brought to light. And then the University of Iowa eventually reached a separation agreement with him. So it does seem like there was a fair amount of turnover, but the main figures here outside of Doyle, Barta, and the Ferentzes have survived.
Yeah, I know the original they sued the University of Iowa, the Board of Regents, Doyle, both of the Ferentzes, the AD. I believe it was in 2021 that a judge dismissed Barta and Ferentz as defendants, and also 6 of the 8 counts. Also trimmed the plaintiffs down from 13 to 7. I think some of their claims were maybe time barred or something like that. So that's obviously part of the reason why the settlement is maybe such a fraction of what the original claim was for. Did you also happen to see that 46% of the settlement, or $1.88 million, is going towards attorney's fees?
No, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, 46% of the settlement. So the lawyers are getting about half of the settlement. The rest is, I guess, split up between the parties. Another interesting part of the settlement terms, I saw that in addition to the $184,000 per player, is that Iowa also has to provide $90,000, I'm assuming, per player to obtain graduate school degrees, and that none of them are actually required to attend Iowa, which seems, you know, fairly obvious, but I thought that was pretty interesting too.
Yeah, those are both interesting points. For anyone who wasn't in the loop on this, basically what the complaints were is that the program culture was asking for these players to conform to a standard that they couldn't possibly meet. It was this sort of clean cut Midwestern, in other words, kind of a like white standard that that the players felt like they were being unfairly held to and demeaned when they weren't able to meet what they thought was an impossible standard. What did you make in terms of you were talking about the payout. What do you make of the Iowa taxpayers needing to basically pay out half of this amount, $2 million?
I mean, I think it's certainly a problem when, as Rob Sand mentioned, this is the third or fourth settlement now on largely the same grounds. That they've already paid out $7 million in the past, and this is another $2 million. So I think that taxpayers have every reason to be upset. I think they have every reason to also demand his ousting. So I'm a little bit surprised that maybe his ousting wasn't part of this settlement, as like was in the original filing. I don't know. Perhaps maybe Gary Barta has, you know, some strong ties to the Iowa AG department or something else of that nature. Who knows?
Well, at the very least, just an incredibly influential person in college sports. The other two individuals we were discussing, Kirk and Brian Ferentz, between the on-field offensive performance and these issues, these race-based issues, how short do you think that the Ferentz's leash is at this point?
I think especially given the fact that the taxpayers now understand that they're on the hook for a lot of this money, it's probably going to add a little bit more of kind of a negative sentiment towards those two. I think that it's pretty likely that we'll see if they come out and they are just horrible next year and they're not winning games and they're not scoring points. I think we might pretty quickly see the fans turn against them. I think the leash is probably a lot shorter than it was before this story broke.
Yeah, as a Minnesota fan, I can't say that I would hate to see that. Last question on this, and then we'll push on to Nick Saban's comments this week. Do you think that we're going to see the NCAA step in here and issue any sort of sanctions, or do you think that this is kind of distanced from what Charlie Baker wants to focus on here in his first 100 days as NCAA president?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't necessarily see them stepping in, especially since it was an actual settlement. It would be surprising to me to see the NCAA come in after, although it is interesting that none of the coaches were actually represented in the settlement negotiations, or at least that they took place without their knowledge or consent. So I'm not sure what role that would play into it, but I wouldn't expect the NCAA to really change anything here. I think the settlement came down and that's probably going to be it.
I agree with that. And so we can leave this story there. For anyone that is new to the show, our main sponsor, our sponsor for a long time now, is Themis Bar Review. Themis Bar Review, best bar review company in the galaxy. If you go right now as a listener of our show to Themis and you sign up with the code GoodSport500, you can save a significant amount on our bar prep classes. Nooch, you used Themis, right?
Yep, I used Themis for, and I'm not even just saying that, I did use Themis for both the MPRE and the bar, and it served me well.
Yeah. And I also use Themis. We both passed the bar. I think Themis is great, particularly because it really boils down the lessons into short kind of bite-sized videos. And that was easier for me to process because let's be honest, bar prep is kind of a drag. So Themis makes it easy and you can make it easy with the code GoodSport500. Go visit Themis today. So anytime that the top coach in any sport speaks on an issue, I think that all of our collective ears, Nucci, that they tune to that. it's pretty important to hear what the greatest are saying, right? And this week, Ross Dellinger at Sports Illustrated, who does a fantastic job writing about college sports, interviewed legendary Alabama head coach Nick Saban. And Saban spoke at length about name, image, and likeness in a Q&A. Basically, Saban said that he's in favor of it, but that he wants to see some change in structure. Saban, the main quote here is that guys are not going to school where they can create the most value for their future. Guys are going to school where they can make the most money. Nucci, can you differentiate those two concepts for me?
No, I don't think I can, because I'm not sure it's possible to. And it is funny, every single time Saban speaks about this, he reiterates, he starts and finishes with, "I'm a fan of NIL." And then he just spends the whole rest of his time kind of coming up with issue after issue after issue. So he also, I don't know if you saw, I have pretty strong opinions on this, as you can imagine, but Saban, he also made comments about athlete compensation and said something to the effect of how they should be standardized and equal across the entire team. I don't know like what kind of pseudo communism Saban is looking for here, but he has like spoken out aggressively in recent years and then always qualified it by just saying, "I support NIL. I think the best players, the most marketable players, the ones with the greatest brand power, those are the ones that are going to get paid the most."
Yeah, well, so that's interesting, especially coming from Saban, right? What he said specifically is that one player should not be earning up here and another player should not be earning down here. It should be more equal. On this past year's Alabama team, I think you saw Bryce Young, quarterback, Heisman Trophy winner, and Will Anderson, who's going to be a high pick in this April's draft. Both of them would have had NIL compensation that was much higher than your run-of-the-mill, even a running back, Jahmyr Gibbs, who was very good, I don't think was making at the level of Young and Anderson were. So do you think that that's a targeted comment? He also said that this kind of thing can distract both athletically and academically. Do you think that he was making a point there?
You know, it's a good question. I'm not entirely sure. I was also thinking about the fact just now, like that it could, if that's really what he wanted, I mean, say certain institutions or certain people tried to implement some sort of policy or something about equal pay. I mean, that's going to hurt recruiting if nothing else. He also called for federal legislation on it. And he kind of defended the NCAA in the process. He said the NCAA gets caught between state laws and their own rules, which I may agree with. You know, I don't know. The other issue I took with it, with his comments at least, were he mentioned something about transferring and how some student athletes are transferring just for the money. Yeah. I mean, Saban has, I looked this up, he's coached at 13 different places, 10 colleges and 3 in the NFL. I mean, are we supposed to believe that money was never a factor in his decision in any of those?
Leaving what? He left Sparty and he went to LSU, right?
Yeah, he's been all over, actually. I didn't realize, but he's been at Syracuse, he's been at Navy, he's been at Kent State, he's been quite a few places. Yeah. So I don't know. I think it's a little bit of it's a little bit hypocritical for him to just, you know, he keeps saying he supports NIL and then he just kind of picks apart everything that NIL is. So
yeah, well, I think just to push back on that a little bit, I think that when you're a coach signing a contract, there is a buyout clause or something like that, right? Like you would have to pay a certain amount of money to Alabama to get Nick Saban out of that contract. And I don't think that necessarily exists beyond like a scholarship limit when it comes to the transfer portal, right?
No, I don't think it does.
So I think that that is one key difference. And I think longer term, if you talk about employment, you're talking about contracts. You're talking about contracts that can't be terminated at the drop of a hat, which is protection for both the player and the institution, and making sure that that your roster isn't getting poached without some sort of due compensation, which I think is an interesting concept and probably is better off for everybody. But that what you said, he really ties those two things together, the transfer portal and NIL payments, and says that that's a double-edged sword and that's getting between the player and money in order to create a market. So a couple other things on this. The point that you made that the NCAA gets caught between the state laws and with the collectives, he says I'm not sure anybody really saw that happening. Isn't it the job of the NCAA that they should have known? They kicked the can down the road forever on this. And then ultimately, they put out the interim policy. He defends the NCAA, but aren't they really the ones that are at fault here?
Yeah, and you're right. It is the job of the NCAA, but I think the NCAA has had a lot of jobs that they haven't done well in the last like 20 years, to be fair. So I can't say I'm shocked that maybe they didn't foresee it, even though all of us and everybody else across the world did. So it would be the job of the NCAA to kind of conform and make sure it works. I think they just really assumed that there would be federal legislation and they kind of just relied on that entirely. And then it never came to fruition. And yep. They were just, you know, kind of caught with their pants down for lack of a better term. But I'm not sure
that they ever thought that the amateurism argument was going to fail. I thought that they really thought that that was kind of a foolproof argument.
Yeah, I think they did too.
A couple other comments that he had were interesting. He said that players should be creating their opportunities. And what we've done now is that some schools are creating the opportunities for them. And I don't think that was the intent. I wonder if that was maybe a veiled shot at A&M. Obviously, he and Jimbo went back and forth last year when Jimbo was bringing in the top class. Then A&M starts this 12th man plus fund that we talked about on this show last week. I think that was maybe a veiled shot at A&M. But at the same time, Alabama's investing like tens of millions of dollars to create an NIL center that they're going to use in order to help student athletes put out content.
Yeah, and to the point about A&M, I think all of Saban's hostility and his comments and all of these things kind of stem from that and from the fact that other schools might have resources that allow them now, at least on the NIL front, to maybe compete for recruits with an Alabama, whereas before they weren't able to. And now, obviously, that goes into the pay-for-play issue, you know, but it's sort of the elephant in the room. But obviously, I think Saban is a little bit angry that other schools have, you know, maybe the playing field is a little bit more level.
Nooch, I take it the other way. I think anything that he's saying is like a threat. Like, if you're going to use this to your advantage and you think that you're going to come and out-muscle Alabama when it comes to resources, like, you got another thing coming. He's not going to be dethroned. I think that he's like Thanos, right? Like, inevitable. I think that the reason that he's saying all of these things is like giving forewarning to other schools. Like, hey, if this doesn't get fixed, if this Tuberville and Manchin bill that he has apparently been consulted on doesn't go through, that there's going to be more Alabama dominance, if that's even possible.
Yeah, it's certainly a possibility. I'm very interested to see how that legislation, how that affects. I mean, obviously, it's going to have a major effect, but I'm curious to see if it actually does come through, what it looks like. And it's also kind of interesting to me that he had an input on it, because obviously he'll be able to, if that's the case, then maybe he can influence a little bit. So.
Yeah. And the last thing on this, I thought was just interesting as to how far we've come on these issues of player compensation, because Dellinger brings up, wouldn't it be easier if you just had employment and then salaries? A lot of this money that is going to the collectives could just be going through the athletic department. You pay the student athletes directly. And I think that at a certain point, even in the last 5 to 10 years, that would have been like an absurdist take. Like, how could you possibly think of directly compensating the student athletes? And now Saban doesn't even bat an eye. It's like, yeah, that could work. I'm not sure how it'll get managed. And to that point, I know nobody feels bad for the coaches. I don't necessarily feel bad either, because they get paid so much. But one interesting thing, and I think Duke is at the forefront of this, they hired Rachel Baker from EYBL, who had worked at Nike for many years, to serve in this general manager role, one of the first people in the country to do this at a high-profile program. I think you're going to see more and more of that, people being hired as general managers of college teams. And that's just going to be so that they can manage everything else that goes into running the program, not just the coaching.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of those, a hire like that would probably be a worthwhile investment, especially for these large, just huge universities where college football and basketball specifically are just such big money generators. I think
huge business. Yeah.
Huge business, just gigantic. Yeah.
So we'll leave it there. Obviously, you know that we're going to continue to track it. Nooch, you wrote a great piece this week about college golf and kind of how NIL fits into that. And I learned a lot. It was, I didn't really know that the rules were so different. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So I had an article this week. I kind of just talked about the barriers that college golfers face when it comes to NIL. And yeah, to your point, the rules aren't necessarily different for them. It's just that college golfers have like a secondary hurdle that they need to jump over. So obviously NIL has really exploded onto the scene in the last couple of years. Problem for college golfers is that they also have to comply with the USGA's amateurism rules. And in addition, the F1 student visa. So I think part of the reason for that, USGA restrictions, they are not allowed to work as a club pro. They're not allowed to accept prize money at tournaments over $1,000. Neither of those are really that big of an issue, I don't think. But yeah. The third restriction is that they can't accept money for teaching lessons.
Yeah.
And that one is unique to golf. And I think college golfers in that respect are losing just thousands of dollars due to that restriction, because there's no other sport where adults are really going to shell out money to take lessons.
Yeah.
I wrote in the thing or in the article, like, you're not going to spend money to go learn how to shoot a free throw.
Yeah.
Like, if a college basketball player puts on a camp about shooting free throws and gets paid for it, like, there's not a ton of people going, but
it's think mostly about kids. Yeah.
Right. All right. Yeah. Exactly. Now think about if a college golfer wanted to put on a clinic where he taught, certain golf skills. I mean, I think they would get paid tons of money, and they're not able to do that because of the USGA rule.
Yeah. And so it's not just that they're not able to do it, right? Because they can post videos about it, but it's a very specific rule, right?
Yeah. So the rule is specifically, it prohibits two-way instruction, which means you can't basically give instruction directed at another person. Yeah. So college golfers can go and they can post videos just kind of maybe showing how to hit a driver, maybe showing how to fix your slice, which I've watched about 40 combined hours of those videos. I'm sure. Yeah. But those can't be directed at a particular person, and they can't do it for compensation. So yeah, they are allowed to post instructional videos and things like that. It's just got to be basically like on their feed. On their Instagram or TikTok or whatever, just, here's how you hit a draw. And that's basically it, but they can't get paid for it.
So one interesting thing there that you said, it can't be directed at anyone. So even though Cameo is mostly acceptable, even for F1 students, because it's like passive income, you wouldn't be able to do that there, because like a Cameo is a specific person getting that instruction.
If it was related to actually giving an instruction on golf, I think that would be restricted. They could do regular cameos, doing whatever they wanted to. But if somebody paid them, say $150 and said, create me a video that is for me, that teaches me how to hit, like an 8-foot putt, how to be consistent with my 8-foot putt. And then they did that. I think that would absolutely fall squarely within the USGA restrictions. So they wouldn't be allowed to.
Okay. Yeah. Do you have any sense of what the rationale behind that is?
I'm not totally sure. I think that all of the rules are, they want to make sure that the lines between amateurism and professionalism aren't blurred. And that's sort of what I wrote in my column or my article. I don't know why I said column. Like I'm some sort of a Nobel Prize winner, but
yeah, no,
Pulitzer Prize winner.
Basically.
Yeah. I think they're trying to not blur the lines between professionalism and amateurism, but I just don't see how permitting college golfers to give instruction here or there. And I even propose just create a notice requirement system. Obviously it's a little bit of an honor system, but just at least permit them to do some instruction per year. I think they're just trying to make sure that college athletes aren't acting as professionals, being paid like professionals, all while, playing college golf and considering themselves an amateur.
Anything else that you want to add about the issues with the F1 visas?
Yeah, the F1 visa, it's another barrier. I know that it does apply to all international students regardless, but at least on the women's golf side, the women's NCAA, as of last year, there were 32% of the athletes were international. And 19% for men. I believe the total combined for all the others is somewhere around 12%. So it's a significant barrier when you consider also that I believe four or five, so basically half of the top 10 And the amateur world golf rankings, both men's and women's, are also international students. So that means that half of the best players in college golf are unable to receive NIL money because of their F1 student visa status, and they're unable to receive money from teaching lessons. So it just seems like two just huge restrictions. And I think that's part of the reason that men's golf and women's golf combined are just like, I think it's 0.5% of NIL compensation.
Yeah, I saw that in your article. So yeah. they're being blocked from like the two main streams of income when it's NIL.
Exactly. And they're behind, college golfers are behind both men's and women's track and field and men's and women's swimming and diving, which, you know, not throwing any shade at track and field or swimming and diving, but I think obviously there's a lot more opportunity for NIL in the college golf space, and it's just not unable to be unlocked yet. So,
especially with golf's rebirth over the last couple of years. So,
yeah, exactly.
That's something that we'll continue to follow. That's something that I think all of us have an interest in getting sorted out, especially if there's going to be some sort of national legislation to help out student athletes when it comes to NIL and have more consistency that we could have some clarity on when it comes to these F1 visas. Last story that we'll hit before we get out of here. Big news, something that we've covered extensively on Conduct Detrimental. LifeWallet CEO John Ruiz, who's definitely not a booster of the University of Miami, put that in print. He's not a booster. Is planning to sue the NCAA because they said that he is classified as a booster. And that's the main point that he wanted to make here. A couple of weeks ago, he said, you know, if it had affected me directly, we're talking about the settlement agreement that was reached between University of Miami regarding the Cavender twins, that he would have sued if it had affected him or his company. Now he has decided that the label of being a booster has affected him and he's going to sue. What are your thoughts on this, John? Do you think this is going anywhere? What's the point?
No, I think it's going anywhere? Probably not. I just read the NCAA defines a booster as a representative of the institution's athletic interests.
Right.
And the classification is earned by either providing donations, participation in athletic programs, financial contributions to the school, providing employment for enrolled athletes, assisting in the recruitment of high school prospects, or assisting in providing benefits to enrolled athletes. I think on a number of those, specifically maybe assisting in the recruitment of high school prospects, kind of falls squarely within what a booster might be. So I'm not entirely sure what the purpose of this is, other than maybe to cause a headache for the NCAA and kind of draw a line in the sand.
Yeah, well, there's a great article on On3 about this by a friend of the show, Pete Nakos. The interesting point that I thought was in here that might be interesting, like for us to get a little bit more clarity on the space. It's not just Miami athletes that are sponsored by LifeWallet, right? These deals are given out to students, student athletes at other schools. It's not just Miami, but it's overwhelmingly Miami. So a point that's made in the article is that maybe the NCAA welcomes this type of case. Do you think that this is something that they want to go to battle about with John Ruiz?
Maybe not. I mean, I did see something to the effect of, that it's just overwhelmingly Miami, but obviously he has been hostile towards the NCAA. So I think this is just another instance where we'll see how Charlie Baker wants to approach this thing, where how much of a hard line he wants to take with, you know, supporters of institutions, whether you want to call them boosters or otherwise. I think he'll have a decision to make and see if he wants to take Ruiz on in this respect.
Yeah. And it's something that we're going to continue to follow as always. John, it's so interesting, right? Like it felt like the NCAA was asleep for like a year and a half, putting out like these random one-off things every so often, maybe to provide a little bit more clarity, but more often than not providing more confusion. And now it's like Charlie Baker stepped up to this buffet and he has his choice of all of the things that he could possibly do. And it's really like a blank slate for him. So it's exciting for us as people who are invested in the space and love to comment on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll see where it goes from here. If there is a court case, I think part of the reason people have said that, as you were alluding to, if there is a court case, then that does open up both parties' discovery. So I think part of the issue that the NCAA has with enforcement is that they are, it's kind of impossible to prove certain, you know, they can, and that's, I think that's why they took the guilty until proven innocent approach recently, is because it is nearly impossible to prove an NIL violation. It's impossible to, you know, you can't force some, the NCAA can't force somebody to turn over text messages, communications. So their approach is just to be like, well, you're guilty if we hear anything about it, unless you prove otherwise. So a court case might actually force that.
Yeah. So we'll put a pin in that one. Definitely something that we'll continue to follow. To close out the show, Nooch, as you know, we've been asking people, all of our reviews on Apple got cleared when we switched podcast hosting services. So we are looking for people to go and leave an honest review of the show. But before we do that, I'm going to read a couple of the reviews. But before we do that, the first person who is listening to this to tweet us a link to the first episode of Conduct Detrimental Ever gets a free shirt. So you have to tweet the link, tag at Conduct Detrimental on Twitter, and you know, you have to be a US resident because we're not paying for international shipping, but you'll get a shirt, a Conduct Detrimental shirt, which are very much in demand and everyone wants one. I have one, they're beautiful. And so—
the best shirt I own.
Yeah, exactly. And so reading a couple of reviews, truly the only place to hear about sports law stories from people in the industry. Love the informational interviews as well. Great podcast for those interested by the intersection of sports and law. Always on top of news stories, always entertaining and exciting stuff from Dan's and their guests. I don't know who wrote this one, but I want to. Highly recommend. The Dans are on the top of their game, and this Taryn character is going places. And then here's one that I wrote. Dan Lust is a golden god, and he needs a hair gel sponsorship. And
we need to get, they still make LA Looks. That was a long time ago. They need to get an LA Look sponsor.
Maybe Maybelline. And the way that he's growing out this beard, Nooch, you've got a great beard. I'm growing mine out. Maybe we could get a Beard Bomb sponsorship.
Maybe.
As always, if you leave these reviews, we'll read them on the show just for fun. Feel free to make them funny. And as always, we appreciate you listening. So for John, at JNucci23 on Twitter. For myself, at TK Sharma Law. And for Conduct Detrimental, at Con Detrimental. Appreciate you listening. Until next time on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.